D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Mit Sibylle Salewski. Die Linguistik, das ist ein Fach, das nicht gerade den Ruf eines brandaktuellen und aufregenden Forschungsgebietes hat. Sprachen dokumentieren, auseinandernehmen, analysieren, das alles klingt erstmal, nun, ziemlich langweilig. Aber Stephen Levinson, das ist sicherlich einer, wenn nicht sogar der renommierteste Sprachforscher unserer Zeit. Also Stephen Levinson, der tut in seinem Vortrag hier bei uns im D-Radio Wissen Hörsaal alles, um dieses Vorurteil, dass Linguistik langweilig sei, zu entkräften. Erfolgreich. Levinsons Vortrag ist voll von Beispielen, die zeigen, wie eng die Linguistik heute mit der modernen digitalen Technik verwoben ist und mit der Spitzenforschung in vielen, ganz unterschiedlichen Fächern. Tonbandaufnahmen im tiefsten Dschungel, das gibt es zwar noch, ist aber irgendwie, muss man sagen, auch von gestern. Wie wäre es stattdessen damit, einfach mal die Tweets aus New York zu analysieren und so ein Bild aller in New York gesprochener Sprachen zu erstellen? Oder Hirnforschung. Warum gelingt es uns zum Beispiel ganz leicht zu beschreiben, wie eine Tasse Kaffee aussieht? Aber dafür gelingt es uns kaum, den ganz spezifischen Geruch des Kaffees in Worte zu fassen. Liegt das vielleicht daran, wie unser Gehirn mit unseren Sinnen verschaltet ist, also an der Neuroanatomie unseres Gehirns? Oder ist es bloß ein sprachkultureller Zufall, dass wir keine Wörter haben für den Duft von Kaffee? Der Vortrag von Stephen Levinson, den wir jetzt gleich senden, hat den Titel Exploring Language Diversity. Mit diesem Vortrag hat Levinson die Tagung Language Documentation Past, Present, Future der Volkswagen Stiftung eröffnet. Das war am 5. Juni 2013 in Hannover. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
I will get straight to business. I want to emphasize the importance of linguistic diversity, just to start with. And I think it's very important to remember that we are the only species on the planet that has such diversity in its communication system. So we have diversity in the sound system, in the meanings, and in the combinatorial apparatus that connects the two. And there's just nothing like this. So there's cultural variability at every one of these levels. And the birds come nowhere near, remarkable though they are. So here's a puzzle. And I think, in a way, that this is one of the, apart from the sheer complexity of human language, this is the extraordinary feature of the system. And we might well ask, you know, how, when, and why does it have these properties? So here's a diagram that shows you, it's a projection of ancient population derived from mitochondrial DNA. And what you can see here is the out of Africa event about 60,000 years ago. And you can see already by, you know, 40,000 years ago or so, the great majority of human population was in Asia. And then we come rapidly now to the Holocene, the end of the Pleistocene, the end of the Great Ice Ages. And there seem to have been about then, one can project, about as many languages as there are now, probably a few more. But the population was very small. We're talking about, you know, 5 million or so humans on the planet. And then, of course, things took off. And I think one can project that there have been something like 500,000 languages since the beginning of anatomically modern humans, that particular lineage. Here's the Austronesian language family, all 1,200 languages. And one of the, you know, extraordinary things about, as I say, this kind of proliferation of diversity, just you see it here. But you think about how has this happened? How does this work? It's of the order of, you know, if you just simply think 1,200 languages in 6,000 years, it's of the order of one every 5 years. But if you think maybe more realistically in terms of all of these sort of parallel strands of evolution and cultural evolution, then we're talking about one language in, say, 170 years. But still, it's an extraordinary proliferation of languages. And I want to emphasize that the origins, you know, the driving forces behind this diversity remain obscure. And one of the reasons is we don't have any sociolinguistics of these small speech communities that we are so much engaged with. I'll spell that out later about what I mean. we can say something, even if we can't say so much about really what's driving this, we can say something about the conditions under which diversity thrives, which are essentially the same conditions as the conditions under which natural species also diversify. So here you see these are plants, and this is it's in the equatorial regions that we have the greatest plant diversity. And similarly for language diversity, it's in the same basic regions, as has been noted often enough. And the background to this appears to be that climatic stability allows this fractionation. And diversity is not driven by rivers and valleys and hills and so on, as in the old story. Okay, so now, again, projecting, it looks like we have had a gradual growth of languages up until about the Common Era, and with, of course, a great demographic influx with the coming of agriculture, and then a steady attrition due to state formation and colonial expansion, globalization, and so on. And so now we're facing this picture, and this is the Google-sponsored Alliance for Linguistic Diversity now has this these rather wonderful, much more accurate estimations of endangerment than we have had before. And by the way, the story looks pretty much as grim as we had thought it was. It's just a little bit, a little bit more optimistic, the projections. So here we are, and I just want to say something now about the importance of language diversity. I'll be preaching to the converted if I say very much here. Let me just say that clearly languages index cultural differences and ethnicities. They also track human history and prehistory, and therefore the colonization of the planet. They tell us about the very nature of language. The diversity gives us the kind of design space, the possibility space for languages. In so doing, it tells us the nature of the underlying biological apparatus must be. And it also gives us, of course, insights into the nature of culture and cognition, because so much of culture is encoded in language. And finally, there is, of course, the sheer human value of languages. So those of us who've been privileged to have done extensive fieldwork have, in effect, had more than one life. We have had more than one kinship system, more than one world, more than one world of ideas and so on. So we are indeed privileged. I won't say more because it has been said so much better by Nick Evans in this wonderful book, Dying Words. Let's come now to the Dobis project. I want also just to celebrate its achievements. And I just remind you that, as Wilhelm Krull pointed out, it was a slow development that led to the whole thing kicking off. There was the original formation of the Arbeitsgruppe Bedrohte Sprachen, and then there was a summer school, I may have the date wrong, was it 1993, somebody said? And so this was the first involvement of the Volkswagen Foundation. And following that, which was a very successful summer school, there was a proactive invitation for projects, for some more systematic project proposal, already on the ground. We held a meeting in Nijmegen, which a number of the prime suspects sitting in the audience today were there, where we discussed, you know, what kind of a thing a best record for a language would be. And then finally, in 1997, this Arbeitsgruppe, having metamorphosed into a proper Gesellschaft, proposed a project in consultation with Wilhelm Krull. And this, I want to just emphasize, this kind of proactive engagement of the foundation in the establishment of all this. And then, of course, as mentioned, the thing kicked off in 2000. So what has been achieved? Let me say something about the triumphs. Well, you've all seen this map of the 100 languages or so that are now in the archive. The archive, of course, will be the kind of legacy, the critical legacy, but it should be a living archive, quite clearly, and not just a dead repository. And there hangs a lot, which I'll say a little bit more about. In the archive now, we have covered about 100 languages from the project, and you've seen again all of these kind of statistics. So here's a quarter of a year of full-time listening to audio, if you if you've felt inclined. And so all of these films, these annotation files, these images, and if you were to digitize the Library of Congress, you know, about half of that. This is extremely rich material, of course, and not only for linguists, also for the native speaker communities, for other people interested in these cultures, anthropologists, ethnomusicologists, and data miners of various kinds. So it's a real demonstration, I think, of what can be done. Access to the data has always been a difficult issue, and things have improved a lot, I have to say. This is great. But I just want to draw your attention to the fact that there's still a lot here that requires permission from the depositors. And I've had a number of data miners. These are people with extensive mathematical or computational skills who could do fantastic things with these data, things that most of us could not do. Okay, our new website already has 2,300 new visitors per month, which is an index of the public interest, I think, in this development. Behind all this, Peter Wittenberg's empire, as it were, these digital servers remotely run from Nijmegen. And then another part of the legacy are these tools, with ELAN being, I think, really the most successful tool in the language sciences at this moment. And then, of course, I just draw your attention to a couple of relatively recent developments, which are extremely interesting and useful tools. In addition to that sort of material legacy is a kind of immaterial legacy too. One of the effects has been to make language documentation part of the scholarly enterprise. Of course, it hasn't been done alone by the Dobez Project, but the Dobez Project also kicked off other projects and stimulated other funding. And so collectively, the effect has been, I think, very substantial. As a result of all this, language documentation has sort of become part of the profession. So there it is. Something significant has changed in the profession. Also, I think there's been something that is broader than linguistics or the ancillary sciences that have been involved in these, like ethnomusicology, anthropology, and so on, that have been involved in these projects. It is this marriage of technology and the humanities, and it has been a kind of spearhead, I think, for, if you like, e-humanities, as it's now called. And the importance of this is partly this idea of that data should be cumulative. We shouldn't have to reinvent this every generation. And this is a real, I think, fundamental improvement in the humanities. Also very important has been the encouragement of teamwork. This is the equivalent of the natural science lab, where, you know, people work together on a project. There's no tradition for this in the humanities generally. So this has also been, I think, an important effect. It hasn't all been perfect. I thought I would just mention some of the ways in which I think perhaps we could have done better retrospectively. It's a pity we didn't collect more technical data of various kinds. We should have collectively shared, you know, phonetic equipment that would have allowed all of the sort of instrumental phonetics that is now perfectly possible to do in the field. We could also have shared experimental gear and experimental expertise, and we could have and should have done more on the sociolinguistics. And by this I mean to understand the internal structure of diversity within the speech communities that we're working in, because that's the engine of cultural evolution. It's the internal engine, just like it is in natural evolution. And so the kind of thing we should have done, you know, is walk across those valleys, go over those hills, doing geographical transects. We should have done cross-generational studies. We should have done just looking at individual variation, which seems, for example, in hunter-gatherer languages, you know, there seems to be much more, for example, pronunciation variability, is my impression. But that's merely an impression. We just don't have the data. Other things that one could complain about, sort of lack of standardized goals, for example, not enough conversation. It's sometimes, of course, in the moribund speech communities, it's very hard to collect. But the point is that this is the fundamental form of language use. This is where children learn the language. And it's a pity then that there's not more data of that kind. And another complaint would be there was no planning at the beginning. This is partly remedied now by these three new projects, but there was no planning at the beginning for explicitly comparative projects. And the lack of systematic comparison of semantic fields is very noticeable, as it was the lack of sort of targeted studies of morphosyntactic domains. Okay, that was just to complain. Now I want to point out that we're at a particular moment where the funding from Dobbs is coming to an end, and that happens to coincide with a kind of looming crisis in linguistics. I should mention that digital archives are not immune from the problems of archives in general. So the future of Dobbs is secure in the sense that the data stream, the bit stream, is guaranteed for 50 years by the Max Planck Society. That's as good a guarantee, I think, as you can get. But the point is that in order to maintain these tools and keep them up to date, keep them usable by current standards, there has to be extensive curation. And that is not guaranteed. So, without living archives, this whole e-humanities phenomenon is itself ultimately perilous. So, I mean, the way around it, of course, is to keep running, keep building the curatorial stuff in with whatever the next new thing is. But it is a struggle, one has to face it. And in addition, as was mentioned, we are facing a sort of generational loss. When my generation retires, it's very likely that many linguistics departments are going to close. And I think that this is natural given the way now you compute undergraduate numbers and outcomes and so on. This is the natural development, but we do have to face the fact that it is a very real situation that we're now in with endangered subject, not only endangered subject matter. Those of you who are sort of skeptical about this, just consider by the very same criteria that we measure the endangerment of languages, namely demography, our subject is endangered. Here are the largest professional associations, so this just gives you a sense for the relative demography of different professions. It's psychology, it's 154, these are all American associations. Neuroscience has 40,000 members, sociology has 15,000, anthropology has 11,000, linguistics has 5,000, only philosophy is smaller. Look, here we are with few linguists, and of course of the 5,000, most of those are not field-working linguists. And 5,000 languages, roughly, still to go, as it were, in terms of, you know, really good description. So we're facing, I think, a sort of crisis, certainly from this, if you put together our demography and this endangerment of languages. I want to make some suggestions about how we might move forward. One is to exploit the fact that we, as a discipline, sit in the middle of things. We have a pivotal position. So we relate to all of the humanities, one way or another. They're basically all language-based. And we are also pivotal for the social sciences. And we're connected in various ways to those branches of the natural sciences that are interested in humans. And so we sit in the middle here, and we should exploit this position. So I wanted to make some suggestions about how we might, you know, recover the high ground, as it were. I think that two ways forward are sort of pointed to by the Dobbs project. One is the use of high-tech methods, and so we should be developing a new way to approach language documentation using high-tech methods. And the second is by, as it were, grabbing the theoretical high ground by connecting to other disciplines and thereby demonstrating our, you know, the essential contribution we can make not only to our own science, but to many other sciences. Let me just talk first about the technical high ground. Here's a representation of the world's telecommunications. My proposal is that we tap into them, because that gives us opportunities for unlimited data. And it's not clear to me how many languages, as it were, out there on the wires or on the wireless, but perhaps as many as 4,000. And I'd like to suggest that two ways to get into this would be to use mobile phone apps on the one hand, and the other to use crowdsourcing as a way of trying to get the documentation up to speed. So I'll just trot through these two kinds of developments. Here's the indication of the number of mobile phone subscriptions. This is Africa. So that's 52% of Africans have mobile phones. Here you see that, of course, not all of them are smartphones, but a surprising number are. And the natural sciences have been involved in using these smartphone apps for data collection now for many years. So here's one called EpiCollect, that basically, this was designed for collecting epidemiological data, so you could report new cases of flu or whatever, but it was also used for ecological purposes. So this involved crowdsourcing of input and then systematic data ingestion, so processing of all of the data that came in. And I think linguists have been quite slow off the mark, but now they're there very clearly with, for example, dictionaries. These are closed dictionaries. More interesting, coming out of Dobre's project, the Ouija dictionary by Bruce Birch, which, you know, where you can add words, sounds, and pictures. This is quite complicated because all of these, you know, conflicts have to be handled in such a system when you can add things to it. And I think this offers a sort of possibility of systematic global data collection. Mobile phones could go in two directions. You can either just think about recording phone calls, of course, with the permission and understanding of the participants. There have been well-funded efforts in this direction, which have, you know, got over the ethical hurdles here. And then we would later get crowdsourcing of transcription, and I'll say something about that in a second. And this, by virtue of the GPS locations of phones and so on, would give us unrivaled information about, like, the internal diversity of language communities, and would give us very informal, the conversation data that's quite hard to collect by other means. So the other technique is to use these targeted apps that are made specifically to collect data. And I'll just take you through a couple of the logic of these. So we in Nijmegen have for years been interested in exploring semantic diversity by very carefully crafted sets of little clips, film clips. So this was cut and break in 28 languages, and the data is collected, so little descriptions of these clips, and then you have to get some data reduction system. That allows the shape of the semantic space to be characterized. In this case, this was breaking, smashing, snapping, tearing, and so on. It gives you a sense, you know, of this sort of separation of parts of things. And then it was possible to map the ways in which specific languages grouped or made semantic distinctions in this space. So this can be transported into the app world reasonably easily. We can also do morphosyntax. We can have clips that we're currently trying to develop, these kind of things, where here's a, you know, one recipient, two recipients, non-human recipient of a kicking event. And so one can build clips like that. Then you can automatically align the acoustic. If you build the set right, there are minimal contrasts between the scenes. So you can then align the acoustics with the protagonists, as it were. And so you now know what sounds go with what protagonists. And then you can also look for marking of participants of different kinds and so on. Interestingly, you can use mobile phones even where there is no mobile phone network, as shown by Stephen Bird, who just went and, you know, had a carry do-it-yourself mobile phone network, which he'd carry with him. And so then he could use the same technology beyond the reach of mobile phone networks. Okay, so I think this is entirely practical. You'd have to motivate the data collection. You need to pipe the data back, and you need to have extremely smart computational tools that will be able to do something with the data that's piped back. We do have a problem with the little keyboards about, you know, fast keyboard input. And so that just brings me to the other development, which is using PCs, as it were, on the internet. And you can see Africa is down the bottom here. And there's Africa in terms of the proportion of internet users, 6%. It's not high, but we only need samples. Here's a map of the Mechanical Turk workers. So Mechanical Turk is an Amazon.com commercial enterprise where you submit a job, and people all around the world, 500,000 of them, do whatever you want them to do in the way like of annotating pictures or doing something that only humans at this point can do. It's a commercial network, but again, it just shows you the possibilities that there are there. There's some wonderful crowdsourcing projects. If you're interested, take a look at Digital Glam. Here's just an example. These are the notebooks of, or the diaries of Jeremy Bentham, which are being just freely typed up by people who are interested in Jeremy Bentham. So the public turns out to be willing to do this. They will transcribe Jeremy Bentham's notebooks, and this project is running ahead of speed, ahead of schedule. There he is in his mummified form. And of course, when you come to linguistics, there are projects running, or have run in this case. This was a study of North American dialects, which was done by Claire Bowen and associates. And it collected in 2 weeks what Bill LeBov spent a lifetime collecting in the way of dialects. And so people just read word lists and sentences and so on. And the data was automatically processed, and you could spit back an analysis of the dialect. So you probably come from Pittsburgh or whatever. So these things are now entirely sort of practical. When it comes to transcription, so insofar as there are Dobe's transcripts, you know, Dobe's tapes that are untranscribed and there are people who have access to the internet, then of course this becomes an entirely practical matter for retrospective transcription of data, because we are all sitting on mountains of untranscribed data. If we can also get at the same time a translation into a local lingua franca, then we can do quite wonderful things. In the first instance, you can do automatic or forced alignment. So Frank Seifert's project in the Dobe's scheme is already doing this very interestingly. So it wasn't obvious that you could do this on random languages, but it works. So this just aligns every segment with the transcription. And if you have a parallel text, you can induce a grammar. And now, the grammars will be, you know, leaky, they won't be entirely right, but the point is, you can do a fantastic amount of automatic processing. What's out there? Just to give you an idea of, you know, the possibility space here. So, what's out there? Well, there are web pages in 1,000 languages that have been collected under this particular website. There's Twitter in 140 languages collected on the same website. And here's a study of Twitter signals. Now, you might, this is sort of rather amazing, this might be interesting. But there are language recognizers built into various websites, like Google Chrome. So now you can study, for example, so you can see tweets, I believe they're called tweets, out of France are always in French. Of course, for the Netherlands, slightly more complicated picture. If you look in the Sudan, only 30% are in Sudanese Arabic. So the rest in various indigenous languages and probably European languages, I don't know the details. Here's a map of New York where the colors code the languages spoken or languages tweeted. So Spanish is everywhere. Sorry, I've discarded English. Not interesting. But so underneath English, you have Spanish everywhere, but you've got Korean in Flushing here, you've got Japanese in Brooklyn, you've got Dutch in the Marine Park, you've got Russian in Coney Island, you've got Indonesian in Staten Island, and you can, so we can have a picture of the entire linguistic community of New York just by going for the tweets. Okay, so I think the future of wiretapping looks just great. And I think that one might be able to get not a, you know, everything from sort of the linguistic diversity in mega cities right down to the village level. And I think that one should have the ambition to try this out and just see how global one can really go with this. And I think it'd be wonderful also just to get survey data, really sort of shallow data, which can nevertheless be tremendously helpful in getting a sort of handle on the linguistic diversity out there. Of course, they're going to be, as it were, telecommunications black holes, places where we just can't reach. But we'll now be able to know what those are. And so we can, in future fieldwork, where we'll be able to target the critical cases, the cases that we need, to, where we know there's data that is absolutely crucial for the language sciences, and we'll be able to go straight for it. So I've just shown the kind of important connections, I think, that still lie ahead for the interconnection between linguistics and computer science. Let's now just go in the other direction and look at how we might take the theoretical high ground, as it were. I think here the leverage lies in comparison across languages. And so I'm just going to illustrate with three little studies about the sort of ways in which linguistics can connect to the other sciences, in the other human sciences, I think usefully, and I suspect for the future of funding in a very important way. Here's one project that we have underway on the language of perception, and we're interested in what it is that's difficult to encode in language. So consider this. This is a complicated thing to describe, but nevertheless, you can do it. You know, just talk about three spheres and two triangles, you know, superimposed. You can describe it. But now try to describe one of those girls in such a way that you can meet one of them at the station. You know, now that's getting very difficult. Consider also the sort of Proustian phenomenon. I mean, you know, it's easy to describe, you know, what it looks like, nice steaming cup of coffee, but very hard to describe the exact aroma of that coffee bean, as it were. And this could be for reasons to do with mental architecture, namely that the olfactory bulb, for example, is wired up differently than the rest of the senses. It goes to the limbic system directly. The idea that there might be a sort of fixed hierarchy of senses comes already from Aristotle. There's his hierarchy with sort of distal senses of sight and hearing, and then the proximal senses of touching, tasting, and smelling. And the idea then might be, and it was his idea, essentially he talked about the accessibility to consciousness, the idea then is that as you go down this hierarchy, we're getting more and more ineffable, it's indescribable. Question, is this true on a universal basis? Does this sort of reflect neural wiring, so the architecture of cognition? We have done a large cross-linguistic, cross-cultural study where we've taken to the field little kits for smelling and tasting and so on. And we have 23 languages, and for each language, what we were interested in is how codable each of these senses are. You know, are there words at all for this stimulus that distinguishes this stimulus from another? Are they abstract in character? Are they source-based? Are they evaluative and so on? And are they used consistently? Here's a codability index for English, so this is really a consistency, a question of consistency of use. And what we see is that color, for example, and shape are very codable, and so is sound, but smell and taste and touch are badly coded and not reliably coded. It's hard to describe exactly what something feels like in such a way that somebody else could recognize it. So that fits the Aristotelian prediction. Here are the 23 languages, and they actually go in all sorts of directions. But let me just pull out English, so there we've just seen that, just for comparison. Now, here is Yelitnya, the language I work on in New Guinea, and you can see it's sort of got a hierarchy in a reverse direction. So it turns out that touch and taste are better coded than the visual sense or hearing. In general, the finding is that taste outranks vision for codability in many languages, that hearing is surprisingly ineffable, smell is mostly poorly coded, but there are exceptions, and the exceptions are interesting. Here's English on the codability level for smell, and here, thanks to Nicholas Burenholt, who collaborated here with Asfa Majid, is the codability for Jahai. What you'll see, what Jahai has a huge range of lexemes that are specific for smells. Exactly what they denote is a puzzle, but they're abstract concepts, and we would find it very difficult to say what exactly they were. Odors liked by tigers, blood of civet species, and so on and so forth seem to be covered by this abstract notion. The upshot is the neuroanatomy of sensual perception doesn't determine the effability or ineffability. Rather, each language has its own codability hierarchy. This seems to be a matter of cultural transmission, so Evelina Vanuk, who also worked in that project, found in a related language a similar range of specific smell terms, and again, with very abstract meanings. Back to this picture of linguistics in the center of the human sciences. Here are the humanities and so on. And here, already just in that one project, you can see the links to psychology, to neuroscience, to philosophy, also to literature, to anthropology, to ecology, and so on. Making these links, I think, will be very important for our future funding chances. Here's another, the second of the little vignettes, which is looking at language processing in its natural habitat. So the natural habitat, as I have said before, basically is conversation. This is the primary use for language. And it's characterized, amongst other things, by this very rapid turn-taking. I say something, you say something. We do about 1,500 turns a day, each of us. And the system has deep ramifications on the nature of the way in which the mind has to process language. And let me just explain that rapidly. A says something, B says something. On average across languages, there's a 200 millisecond gap between the two. And we've done 10 languages we've looked at in detail, and you get a remarkably similar pattern. One possibility that I'm seriously entertaining here is that getting access here to a almost like a pre-linguistic system. This seems to be set up in such a mechanical way, regardless of the different languages, right? You see the same temporal organization for language organizations. So I suspect that we're picking up some kind of phylogenetically more ancient layer in language organization. Anyway, what's interesting about this is that psycholinguists have shown that you can't speak without a giant run-up. So it's like the long jump. And the giant run-up is about, for one word, so you know what you want to say, from the moment it comes out, if it starts to come out, it's 600 milliseconds. If you want three words, it's going to be 900 milliseconds. So they've got this giant run-up, and we know a lot about the internal organization of this now, thanks to the work of my colleague, Pim Lehfeldt. But here's the point. So here you've got this turn-taking system. A says something, B says something, you've got a 200 millisecond gap, and now you've got a 600 millisecond run-up, at least. So what's interesting about this is that it means really that when you're listening to somebody speaking in conversation, you're already predicting what they're going to say, and you're designing your response in the middle of what they're going to say. And that is an extraordinary process when you stop to think about it. And now come back and think about linguistic diversity. How does this work when languages order their elements in different ways? Some of them put a lot of important stuff right at the end here. How can this possibly work? So there's a puzzle. We have been looking at verb initial languages because, you know, one end of the extreme is how do you get all of this stuff worked out so fast? So I'm going to just tell you about Tzeltal, which is a Mayan language spoken in Mexico. So here's a picture being described by an English speaker, and they'll say the woman is chasing the chicken or something like that. If we eye track this, you'll see that they basically first look at the woman. When that's ready to go, they start speaking. Then they look, that's what you can see in here, the object, at the chicken. And they start to encode that, and that's what you can see here. That's how English works, and psycholinguists have assumed that's how all languages work. You know, you basically start speaking before you know exactly where you're going to end. Now, if you speak a language where the verb is up front, that is not going to work. You're now going to say, is chasing the chicken the woman, right? And what you in fact see if you do eye tracking is that the people first do look first at the subject, then rapidly at the object, then they're starting to think about encoding the verb, and then they start speaking. So it's a much greater sort of run-up of language processing before you can begin speaking. How does that interact with the turn-taking system? Well, we thought, oh, they must be slower turn-takers. They must just have more space between their turns. So we wired people up, so we had separate sound tracks when they're speaking. You know, you've got separate records of the two, which allows automatic processing of the signal. Here's French automatically processed. It's about 20,000 turns of speaking. And when it's averaged like this, you can see it's a bit slower. So the mode is at about 300 milliseconds, but it doesn't concern us. What you'll see here is that Tzeltal is fast. In fact, it's so contrary to our supposition. It's super fast. So how do we explain that? We then began to think, well, we knew that Tzeltal has a funny discourse structure. So the standard discourse structure is I introduce a new something into the discourse. So in this case, it's thus the younger brother has left there. And now you repeat it. That's the standard operation. Yes, the other Mayanist nodding. And so psycholinguists talk about this as priming. It's much easier to say something if you've just heard the same thing or something with the same structure. So we then could have a look at these diagrams. So now we've got these diagrams. We're pulling out the repetitions. And you can see they're, in fact, very fast. They're so fast that they're mostly in overlap. And then if you pull them out and now just look at the non-repetitions, now you'll see they're in positive territory. Now you can see the mode is like 150 milliseconds. But it's still fast, by the way, so we don't know. We don't really understand it. But our point is simply this. Here you've got this rather fixed system of turn-taking with its tight timing, and now you've got to fit a specific language with its different properties into this. And languages are going to have to find a way around this because it looks like this turn-taking system has sort of phylogenetically ancient and it's sort of fixed. And one of the things that Tzeltal has up its sleeve is this discourse structure. It does other things as well, we partially understand. The suggestion is that languages have to have workarounds around this kind of problem. again, this kind of project connects to psychology and neuroscience, to human ethology, to sociology, but sociology is very interesting conversation, and so on, and also ultimately perhaps to human evolution. Last little vignette about how to get into the Pleistocene with a time machine. Here is the deepest language family in time depth that we know, Indo-European. This tree is constructed by using bioinformatic technology imported into linguistics. I think this is, you know, wonderful new development. Many of my colleagues are very skeptical, but I think it's just a real transformation of what we can do in historical linguistics. The trouble is, it's limited how deep in time we can go. And that's because most of this work is based on cognates, on words that share meaning, sound meaning correspondences, and these are eroded over time. So roughly, even for the most conservative vocabulary, like the 200 most conservative words, you know, half of them again are lost in a couple of thousand years. A natural limit to how far we can get using this system. And now the question is, can we break this time barrier, which is effectively about 10,000 years? I believe we can. It's going to be difficult to be sure we have. One of the ways in which we might know that we have is if we can show, for example, at the moment when, at the end of the Pleistocene, all that glaciation melted and the sea levels rose over 100 meters right around the world. And so land bridges all around the world were lost. And so if we can somehow get back into that, if we can show connections across these lost land bridges, we would have some evidence that we're getting back into the Pleistocene. I'm just going to show you three little ways in which we can do that. One of the techniques we're using is using structural features, the bony structure of languages, as it were, rather than the lexicon, rather than the words. So if you use these structural features and apply the same bioinformatic methods, you can get, for example, this is a tree. It doesn't look like a tree. You just think about it as the mobile, which you pull up in the middle and it'll hang like a tree, and which we obtained from a bunch of outlying East Papuan languages. If you know these languages, it makes eminent sense, except for the fact that you can't map it nicely onto the geography. Why would this middle, this is the structural middle of the tree, you know, be way out in the east in the Solomon Islands? Well, if you know that all of this was one island up to 10,000 years ago, then I think it makes sense. Here's another case. The ancient continent of Sahul, which joined New Guinea and Australia, was there until about, till about 8,000 years ago. My colleague Michael Dunn, using structural features, has done, so this is kind of a wonderful mosaic. What you see here are features that are typical, for example, of Australian languages here, and then of the Trans-New Guinea phylum, Austronesian languages, and so on. What this software does is ask, how many founding populations were there in that Sahel area? And the answer it spits out is 8 on the basis of this data. And what's interesting about this is that we now know that all of these folks came through Southeast Asia and picked up the genes of Denisovan man or woman. This is the sister clade to the Neanderthals, which is carried by about 6% in all of these populations. So those 8 migrations were further downstream than that. So we're already getting into sort of very interesting territory. And you can pick up the signal across the Torres Straits. This is the purple here, or the green across. Final example, the Bering Straits between Alaska and Siberia. There's some reason to think, but uncertain, but some reason to think that we've picked up a signal in the lexical material or morphological material of connections across here. But recently, Dan Diddy, you and myself have been doing structural stuff, and we've picked up a structural signal which is much more widespread. In fact, goes right through the Americas. And we did this by now doing a trick. So we took the structural, the bony facts of language, as it were, the structural features. And now we said, well, if you were looking at vocabulary, you'd only use the most conservative vocabulary. So let's just only use the most conservative structural features, which, of course, we had to then find out. But if you only use the most conservative structural features, then you get a connection between Eurasia and the Americas. So in this sort of way, I think this field is really ripe for, you know, future development. it allows us to use language to trace this great human diaspora. This future work in this field totally depends on better data. We're all held up by needing much larger, better data sets. And of course, these have to come from the endangered languages of the world. And if we do get on with this, I think we'll really understand how the language diversity on this planet arose. So this is a project that also links right across the sciences. And I'm now putting together all of these projects, and you can see we have wonderful connections. You know, this is why linguistics, as I see it, it's the sun in the solar system of the human sciences. So, conclusions. I think Dobitz has taught us many lessons, and I think amongst them, of course, is how to marry technology and language documentation. I think this is a signal lesson for the e-humanities. We did miss some tricks, of which one of them, I think, was this lack of systematic comparison, which lowers our ability to talk to other disciplines. And I think in future developments, two things are going to be crucial. Now, the first is to really exploit this marriage with technology, and the second is to engage with other disciplines so that our work is, you know, eligible for much wider funding opportunities than currently it is. Thank you.
Das war der Sprachwissenschaftler Stephen Levinson darüber, wie die Linguistik zum Herzstück aller Sozial- und Lebenswissenschaften werden könnte. Levinson hat diesen Vortrag am 5. Juni 2013 gehalten auf der Tagung Language Documentation Past, Present, Future der Volkswagen Stiftung in Hannover.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.